Hey, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. Well, I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper an author who I really admire. His work is fantastic. It's Dr. Andrew Scott Cooper, and his book is his paperback version of his book is being released today. The book is called The Fall of Heaven, The Pahlavis, and The Final Days of Imperial Iran. Hi, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, Coop, I'm so happy to have you back because, as I explained last time when you were on, I think this book is so important, and it's come out, the paperback version. I'm so happy that they brought it out because it is an important book for people to read.
Yes, I think it's really very timely right now, given what's happening in Iran and also throughout the Middle East region. A lot of people are looking back at that critical period in the late 1970s with the Shah to try and understand how we got to where we are.
And it is difficult for most people to understand. You know, here in America, of course, most people aren't too aware of a lot of history. And this history is not well known. But it is so important because Iran has really spread out and is causing so many problems in the world. Many of these problems could have been avoided, I think, if things had been played out differently. So let's talk. Now, this is, of course, we're talking here about we're not going to say the last Shah of Iran because we don't know if he's the last Shah of Iran, right?
That's a good point, actually. There's a revival going on inside Iran now of the Pahlavi name, and the Shah's son, Reza Pahlavi, is very, very popular inside Iran. I'm sure that your Iranian-American listeners will be aware of that.
Oh, yes, because, you know, at one point, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte went off and they said that's the end of the Napoleons. Well, you know, not too long after that, a new emperor came along. And so you don't know. And there are people in Russia who really would love a czar, a real czar. And you know, so you never know, right?
Well, and let's not forget the restoration in Spain in 1975, where the crown, the monarchy, was brought back under King Juan Carlos after Franco left power. I mean, that was a different situation. It was a peaceful transition. But we do have incidents of restorations throughout modern history. So he's in a very interesting position right now.
Exactly. And so let's talk. I want to talk about Reza Pahlavi and about his, you know, so many people, when they say the Shah of Iran, they think this horrible monster, this ogre, this despot, this guy who just went around killing people all the time. And it's so far, and who was very egotistical. And it's so far from the truth. So I think we'll go there. We'll talk about him, but then we're going to talk because this is a royal wedding weekend. And so so I think everyone will really find all of the stories that you have written here and all the information that you have given about the Empress of Iran so fascinating. But let's sort of do the groundwork here. Yep. Most people, they hear the word Iran, they hear the word Persia, and they're a little bit confused. So let's lay the groundwork and then let's talk about how Reza Pahlavi came about.
Sure. Well, of course, Persia was renamed Iran in the 1930s by the Shah's father, Reza Shah, who founded the Pahlavi dynasty. He came to power in 1921 in a coup. The country had been in a period of protracted chaos and conflict. Many people don't understand or they're not aware that during World War I, Persia was invaded by four armies from the west and from the north, and up to 1 million people died in that conflict, many of them from famine and disease. So, of course, then Iran was invaded again in 1941 by the Russians and the British. And I think that when you hear Iranians today talking in such strong language about feeling threatened by the US. Well, they're really going back to those periods and during World War I, World War II, when they were invaded. And let's not forget that the United States occupied Iran during World War II as well. So that was part of the Allied presence in Iran. And the Shah, the late Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, although he was a U.S. ally, he was very much aware that the Americans, the British, and the Russians had stationed themselves in his country after he succeeded his father on the throne in 1941. So there is a lot of nationalism that comes into this debate. And I think it's important that Americans understand that when Iranians, you don't have to agree with anything the Islamic Republic says, but to understand where the fear of possible American aggression could come from. And of course, then in 1953, the United States, through the CIA, participated in the coup that overthrew the Mossadegh government. So there's a history of involvement and interference inside Iran. Iran today, I think, is a very troubled country. I think that many young Iranians feel very detached from the Islamic Republic, and they are looking back to this period in the late 20th century to really try and understand where the country took what they regard as a very bad turn. And of course, when you look back, you inevitably end up in the 1970s period, which I think for many historians has become, we call it the bridge decade. It's a really critical decade when in order to understand what happened around the turn of the century, we're going back to the 1970s, because that's where there were so many changes in the United States, but also changes in the Middle East with the rise of Islam and the rise of extremism that we're seeing coming through.
Well, we had a period there where when the Shah finally started to rule the way that he wanted to rule, yes, which was to modernize Iran, to bring it into at the time the 20th century, to make it a really important country. And so that started happening about what year?
Well, he had been on the throne for about 20 years, a little bit over 20 years. By the mid-60s, he felt confident enough that he could rule independently of the US and the British and inside Iran too. He was in a very strong position after 1963 when he crushed an uprising led by a guy called Ayatollah Khomeini. And I think many people don't understand that Khomeini made two bids for power. In 1963, he was defeated. And then in 1978, he made his second bid for power. And of course, he won in January 79. But the Shah really took firm control of the country in the mid-60s. And I think that what then followed through the mid-60s through to around the year 1978 is a fascinating story of great promise and also enormous tragedy, because the Shah believed that he was modernizing his country. He invested vast sums of money, not only in weaponry, but also in infrastructure. If you ever travel to Iran today and you're on the highways or you're in Tehran or the big cities, you look around you and the infrastructure was put in place by the Shah during that period. He invested in schools, education, literacy. He really led the way on women's rights. And of course, that's where Farah Pahlavi comes into the story, because she was, when they married, she became the point person on social issues and played, I think, a very, very important role in women's rights, but also children's rights, literacy. She was the patron of dozens of organizations. And so she had a very active presence in Iran, and actually still does today. I mean, she is as popular inside Iran, possibly even more so than she was when they were in power in Tehran.
In fact, when you look at Iran, and you realize how very important she was. And we're talking about a Muslim country. Even today, we don't have any Muslim country where a woman has such a vital role in in the country, in shaping the country, and in thinking about how to make the country a better place.
Mm. You know, many people, when they think of the Shah and his relationship with women, they think of that notorious interview he did with Arianna Fallaci from 1973, where he said, you know, women never influence me. You know, I can't think of the name of a single famous woman who cooked. No, he made that. And actually, what he was, he was very annoyed with Arianna Fallaci, and he deliberately provoked, she was provoking him, and then he thought he was going to be flip in his remarks. And it was really unfortunate. I mean, this was a fellow who from the time he was a kid, watched his father emancipate the Iranian woman. And we have correspondence, which is actually cited in my book, where he writes to this letter to his father from school in Switzerland and says, you know, you've opened my eyes to the most important issue in our country, which is the role of women. And he took great pride in the fact that women entered the workforce during the 1960s and 70s. He gave them the right to vote. They were allowed to divorce on their own terms. He gave them the right to an abortion if they wanted it. He liberalized society. Now, that doesn't mean all Iranian women wanted to take part, to take advantage of those reforms. And in fact, I think that a lot of the backlash to the Shah can be traced to moving very quickly on women's rights, the clergy in particular, but also many men, Iranian men, really found this quite threatening. I mean, if you can look at what's happening in our own society today to see how this movement moves and fits and starts, and you're in, at that time, a very conservative Shia Muslim society. So the Shah was moving very quickly, and Farah was someone who really took on the role of first lady. She embraced the role, and she leaned in, and she traveled the country. She eventually became one of his ambassadors to travel around the world. She did very high profile diplomatic tours. She met with the prime minister once a week. She had her own budget, so she was able to spend money and distribute funds from the oil revenues. So Farah was a remarkable figure, and I in the book I say that she was one of, well, my argument is that she's actually was the most influential queen consort of the 20th and late 19th centuries. I mean, you really have to go back a couple of hundred years to find another consort who was given as much influence and power as her, as she was. And that power came from the Shah. And so the when people say, well, the Shah was a sexist and a misogynist, you look at Farah and you think, well, if that was true, he would not have allowed his wife to be a partner to him. And certainly she was very different to his first two wives, Princess Fawzia of Egypt and the very famous Soraya that everyone still remembers.
Now, of course, one of the stories that I love in that in your book, which, by the way, I just want to tell people, now, this is a nonfiction book, but it reads like a thriller. You have done you have done a marvelous job in the pacing, in the way that you have a slow reveal. So there's always a mystery where, although we know the end result, we don't know everything that's going to happen. And it's really an exciting read from that point of view.
I would think that if anyone has read my first book, Oil Kings, it's that it's a similar, there's similar pacing. That's where I really learned to, as you call the slow reveal, which I think is a great way of describing it. You know, history is exciting to me, and I'm very passionate about good historical narrative so that we can all participate in these great debates of our time. And it doesn't mean that you have to read my books are, they are scholarly and they are used in the University of Pennsylvania, Columbia University, London School of Economics. But I write for everyone. I don't just want to write for the academy. And I'm an investigative researcher. And I really believe that good history writing, it should be exciting. And the story about the Shah in the 1970s is just so fascinating. As you know, you've read it, there's this crime mystery involving a fellow named Imam Musa Sada embedded in the story. And so there are these different strands that come through, and I like weaving it all together so that when you're reading it, you think, I don't understand, well, where's this person coming in and how do they fit in? But then everything comes together or should come together in the last couple of chapters. And then as you say, there's that slow reveal and you sort of go, oh, now I understand. And I think the story of the revolution is so, so important. And it can be understood. It's not that, you know, I constantly have people say to me, oh, you know, the Middle East is so complicated, Iran is so complicated, I don't understand. Well, I've broken it down for you in this book, and I've tried to do it in a way that I think tells very important stories about how the main principles inside Iran in the royal court behaved and the decisions they were making. And it's really important, I think, for us today to try and, when we look at what's happening in the news, we try and sort of understand the pressures on the people who are making decisions. And I think you look at the Shah, and we today have so much more empathy for the guy and what he was trying to do.
And when, for example, one of the parts that the minute I read it, I said, oh, wow, this author just has the right way to tell a story. When you talk about how the Empress went to a leper colony. This is, yes, some, you know, these kind of little details, these kind of stories are what make the people come alive and why this book is really such a great read.
I mean, she was the Princess Diana of her time inside Iran. I mean, that's why, and actually, you know, she told me that the people in the leper colonies still find ways to contact her. Children who were educated in her literacy programs, who were trained as filmmakers, who were trained as artists through all the programs she started, they still write to her today. I mean, she has this, she's fascinating. I sort of said to her when I was talking to her, I've met her a number of occasions. She's really a workaholic and she doesn't like that expression, but when she contacts me, she will often contact me at 10 o'clock at night. And I know that it's because she's at her computer and she is doing her work. And so the question is, well, what work could a 79-year-old former empress possibly be doing at this time in her life? Well, she is regarded as a mother figure by millions of Iranians inside and outside the country. She, at any one time, we'll have about 20,000 emails. She can't possibly reply to them all, and she doesn't have a big staff. I mean, the money's not there for her to have a whole office. But she supports Iranian designers and dressmakers and artists, and she will be going to events. She will speak out on issues affecting Iran, for example, human rights issues affecting women in Iran. So she has a very... She has continued since the revolution actually at this rapid pace of working. And I think she learned from the Shah. She learned how to run an office. She learned how to manage her patronages. With the lepers, that the leper colony was really a turning point for her. It was the first time she said to me that she understood that she had a moral power to actually change things. That she went in and it was going to be a staged photo op, and the person who was guiding her had the bread for the lepers and just threw the bread on the ground in front and didn't want the lepers to come near the queen. And Pharaoh was so appalled that they would just throw the food at the lepers like they were dogs, that she pushed this person away and sort of walked right into the lepers and embraced them. And they loved her for that. And she didn't just pay a visit to the leper colony. Afterwards, she consulted international experts. She had doctors fly into Iran. She said to her husband, "I want you to build a model leper village." That village had businesses. It had a cinema. It was completely self-sufficient. They did consider actually integrating it into the surrounding neighborhood, but the lepers themselves said, "No, we would like our own community." And one of the interesting things that came out of it is that local people in the region then went to the leper colony and said, "We would like to work for you." So Farah kept up. She took on an issue, and she didn't just appear and shake hands and smile and do the photos. She actually followed through, and she maintained all those relationships, and she still maintains the relationships when she can.
Well, it is exactly like Empress Diane, who went out to the landmines, was right there,
I was working in the landmines campaign as the lead researcher for the U.S. campaign to ban landmines, and that was 96-97. And so I went through that whole process with her and sort of watching. My superiors worked with her in the field. They took her out to Bosnia on that last trip. And I remember when she was killed in the car crash, I ended up doing a lot of TV work in the States because the more experienced campaigners were in Canada negotiating the landmines treaty. So I was particularly interested to see how Farah, what can you do when you're a first lady? What is the role that you potentially can carve out for yourself? And I think in this country, we have someone like, Betty Ford is very interesting, because she didn't want the role of first lady, but she certainly took it on and embraced it. And I think that then you have a personality like Farah Pahlavi, who even before they were married, the Shah sat her down and said, "Look, I've had two wives before you. Neither of them was really an enthusiastic public figure." And he said, I need a partner. I need someone who is going to come out with me or work independently, and we're going to do this together. And that, I mean, he chose exactly the right person.
And one of the funny stories in the book, I mean, it's not funny, but it is so, again, so close to Diane, was that the chase through Paris by the paparazzi.
Yes. I mean, that was December 1959. And of course, Farah was being educated, was an architecture student in Paris. She was Iranian, but her mother allowed her to go to France on her own to go to school, architecture school. And she talks about how, after the engagement was announced, that drive from the school to the airport and how terrifying it was. Even then they had men on motorbikes and scooters and cars driving through the streets of Paris. And, she said it was pretty scary. I mean, that was 1959. So of course then, you sort of look at what happened since then.
Exactly. There are so many parallels. And one of the things since we're, as I said, it's a royal wedding weekend, let's talk a little bit about the royal wedding, because it was pretty spectacular.
This is the Shah's wedding with Farah.
Yeah,
it was spectacular. And, she was 20 years his junior, but she has a strong personality. And I've subsequently got to know very well her friend Ellie, who is in the book, actually. And Ellie now lives in Greece. I just had lunch with her actually last week.
Oh.
She was telling me about the when the tiara arrived on the morning of the wedding, there was a car pulled up from the Bank of Iran. There were, had, of course, security, and they took the jewels out. And she said, you know, the tiara, they look, the diamonds looked like sugar cubes. They were so big. And by the end of the day, the end of the night, the new queen of Iran, just, she had a splitting headache because wearing jewelry that heavy for that long and
A couple pounds of diamonds on your head.
And also it was something that the queen actually said to me. She said, look, you know, it's not like we had velvet padding in our tiaras. She said, it wasn't until I went to Buckingham Palace in 1960, I think it was 61. And she said to the queen, to Queen Elizabeth, you know, my God, I've got a headache. And the queen said to her, you're not telling me you don't have velvet padding in your tiaras. And Farah said, no, I just inherited thee. And the queen said, I mean, this is sort of a summation of the conversation, but she said, for God's sake, let me help you. And so the tiaras in Iran from that point on were sort of refurbished, you could say, so that Farah could wear them for hours at a time, and they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't cause headaches and be so uncomfortable. And by the way, if you ever go to Tehran, those of you who want to go to Iran, you certainly can, go and see the collection of royal jewels in the Bank of Iran vault. It is one of the great...
it's amazing.
The queen's, not only the tiaras, but the crown she wore in the 1967 coronation is there, and it's absolutely stunning. And she helped that design that.
And of course, who provided her dress?
Gosh, you may have to tell me. It was Dior in 1959. Yes.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, things like this, you know, women remember this, and we're all waiting now to see what Meghan Markle is going to be wearing this weekend.
I hope the situation with her family settles down, because this is not, unfortunately. I mean, the Shah had problems with his relatives, and actually, as one person is quoted in the book as saying that one of the Shah's problems is he had too many brothers and sisters. The more brothers and the more siblings you have, the more potential there is for embarrassment and people to cash in. And that's a sad situation that we see right now with the Markle family. And we've seen that happen in other royal occasions.
But actually with Farah, her family was pretty good. They, one of her, her grandfather had gone, where did he go to military? He went to military school, right?
Well, the irony is her grandfather was in military school in Tsarist Russia and had to flee the Russian Revolution. And I mean, he was Iranian Persian, but he went to Russia for a training. And so there is that sort of interesting aspect where the grandfather had to flee the Russian Revolution, and then the granddaughter was the queen of Iran and had to flee her own revolution in her own country. But she came from a very, very good family. I mean, Farah was – there was no insecurity when she was dealing with the Shah's relatives, because she felt, look, you know, my family has served the Qajar dynasty before you, and they were not high aristocrats, and she was raised as an upper middle class girl, but she came from very good stock, and she came from a very small family. I mean, her father died when she was very young. She was raised by her mother and her uncle and aunt and her cousin. So it was just really the five of them who were living together until she went to school. And that meant that there were few opportunities for, you know, these relatives kind of come out of the woodwork and say, you know, I'm going to cash in with the paparazzi. I will say this, though. One of the stories in the book that I think is very interesting involves the Shah's daughter, Shahnaz. And I think many people don't understand that the Shah's first child, to Queen Fawzia, actually converted to militant Islam while he was still on the throne in the mid-1970s. And I think in terms of family embarrassment, You couldn't get more embarrassing than that situation with the Pahlavi family. That was a very, very difficult time for the Shah and created enormous strain. And in fact, the father and daughter were completely estranged towards the end.
Now, you know, just recently I've been reading, they've been putting out little bits and little stories about Iran. And so I noticed that, I don't know which publication recently mentioned that Khomeini contacted President Kennedy just 2 weeks before he was assassinated, asking for help from America. So really so many things would have been different for Iran if Khomeini had taken over, if the Ayatollah had won in 63, all of this development and all of this major work that the Shah did would never have happened.
It would never have happened. I mean, Khomeini at that point was not, by 63, he had decided that he was obviously had a very strong ego. When he was a little boy, he always told his playmates that he wanted to be the Shah. He wanted to play the role of the Shah, and you know, if they were playing out in the yard, I'm the Shah, and I'm the one who's going to be in control and decide who does what in this game. So he, from the time he was a kid, actually, he had this ambition to. He just had this very strong, compelling personality. And in 1953, despite his later attacks against the United States, and accusing American diplomats of being CIA agents during the hostage crisis. In 1953, he actually, we now believe that he supported the CIA overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh's government. So, you know, this is also an opportunist, and he was someone who bided his time. He was very lucky when he went up against the Shah, because the Shah was a very soft-hearted guy, and the Shah saved his life twice. He was two occasions where he could have had him knocked off, and the first was in 63, and the Shah spared his life after the rebellion, and the second time was in 1978, and this is very interesting and I think important, where Saddam Hussein contacted the Shah and said, look, this guy Khomeini is going to cause problems not only for you but for us in the entire region. You give me the word and let me take care of it. And obviously, we know what he meant by take care of it. And the Shah said, "No, I can't order the murder. I cannot sanction a crime against a priest." And the rest is history, as we say. But Khomeini was, in that sense, very fortunate in who he went up against. It was a case of a lot of luck, a lot of skill, and timing. And unfortunately, a lot of Americans, including some U.S. diplomats, believed the hype that Khomeini was going to be the Mahatma Gandhi of Iran. I mean, in the book, there's actually a quote from the Ambassador Sullivan at the time, in Tehran in the late 1978, near the end, near the final collapse, where he actually says, he compares Khomeini to Gandhi.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I can't handle that man, Sullivan. I really can't.
I was actually earlier this year, last year, I was in Washington. I was asked to give a presentation at the State Department on my book. So I was speaking in the library, and afterwards a woman came up to me, and she said, I'm Ambassador Sullivan's daughter. She was working as a consultant for the State Department, and she said, "I haven't read your book. What do you say about my father?" Oh. And I said, "Well,
okay, yeah."
She said, "My father has been maligned," and you know, she was obviously, I understand that she's very defensive, but you can't not look at those documents and look at that historical record and understand that the ambassador made a terrible set of miscalculations at the time. But then you have to say that so did the Carter administration, and within the palace, the Shah made miscalculations too. But Sullivan made some real big mistakes there, and it's sort of a great tragedy. There was a power vacuum in the Carter administration on foreign policy at exactly that moment, and that's really because everyone else was distracted by the Camp David peace accords. They weren't paying attention to Iran, and
that's always a fatal mistake. You have to pay attention to Iran.
You have to pay attention because Iran is one of those countries in the world that demands that you pay attention to it. I mean, it's not necessarily about the size of the country. It's very much about location. It's location, location, location. It's about resources. It's about the fact that this is a country that this was the first sole superpower on the planet under Cyrus. This was the first unipolar empire. And I think that, Iranians today, that they still go back to that period and they say, look, all we're asking for is you to treat us with respect. We used to run the world. You're running the world now. We used to run the world. There is that side of the Iranian personality that's very interesting because the history is so important to them. And I think the history is not so important to Americans, and it's just a different way of seeing the world.
Exactly. Well, to entice readers to that they should read this book, let's talk about the relationship with JFK and the trip of the Pahlavis to Washington, D.C., because we just recently went through this big state dinner and we saw the importance of a state dinner and how it really has a meaning. And at that time, when the Shah and the Empress came to Washington, set that stage for us. So, because I think this is one of the fascinating stories. That's why your book is so exciting. It's just so much fun to read.
Well, you're absolutely right about the importance of state visits and state dinners. Although it appears to be a choreographed affair, the symbolism is very important in terms of what the messaging. And actually, the messaging is still very much sort of in an interesting way bound up in the uniforms, the clothing, what the women are wearing. And in 1962. April 1962, Shah comes, the king and the queen, the emperor and empress, come to Washington, and the Shah is very insecure with John Kennedy. Kennedy did not like the Shah, and Robert Kennedy hated the Shah. Robert Kennedy, there was, I think, a lot of very fair speculation that the Kennedys would have liked the Shah to have been bounced from power. This was the early 60s, and the American president was feeling quite cocky at that time, and the Shah understood that there was this bad relationship. So he did something very interesting. It was the first time he really had deployed Farah as this soft power in Washington, and so Jackie Kennedy looked very elegant and beautiful. She had a sort of pink chiffon gown and a white top and very discreet jewelry, because I suspect she understood what she was about to go up against. Farah Pahlavi came out of the car, and you can look at these photographs online. Rather remarkable. She's wearing a gold gown.
Oh, it's amazing. People really have to go and look at it.
Yeah, they do. I actually asked her, was that spun from gold thread? And she laughed and she said, don't be ridiculous. but it looks like there are jewels embedded in the gown. And she wore this gorgeous set of emeralds, and which you can see in the Iran National Bank today. And she just blew the competition out the water. I mean, all the photographers, all the reporters, all their eyes were on Farah. As I think it was a Washington Post Society columnist said, we've never seen jewelry like it in this town before. And Farah became a very, obviously very important figure for the Shah in that way, and that this was sort of the early 60s, very glamorous period. And
she was very popular in the magazines. Magazines had been covering them as the romance and all the glamour behind them.
Yes, I mean, the Shah, you know, she was the Shah's third wife, and the Shah and the Shah Banu had very high profiles in the United States at that time. And remember, when they came through in April 62, they were given a ticker tape parade in New York City. And in fact, if you're down on Wall Street, when you're walking up Broadway, look down the next time you're there and look at the pavement, and you will see marker stones marking every ticker tape parade that's ever been held in New York City. And I was there I used to live in New York, and I was just walking one winter morning, and there's the one for the Shah of Iran and for Farah. And this was a pretty spectacular trip. They were in the country for a couple of weeks. They went out to Los Angeles. They were entertained by Hollywood celebrities. So Farah herself, though, was very uncomfortable on the trip, and she was very upset with the Kennedy people because she believed they allowed Iranian opposition students who were picketing them to get close, and she felt that that was deliberate, that they had been deliberately allowed to disrupt the trip to send a message to her husband that, look, don't get too cocky. We can make life difficult for you. I asked her about the gown at the White House that night and said how stunning it was. And she said, I preferred what Jackie was wearing. And she said, after that, I changed the way I dressed. I really created a more streamlined look. And certainly that's true. She was and is today still recognizably elegant and stylish and beautiful. But she became one of the world's most stylish women through the 60s and 70s. And it sort of goes back to that trip where she looked at Mrs. Kennedy and thought, it's actually, there's something to be said for dressing down and for being very spare in how you present yourself.
Well, very much like our current First Lady, who has this knack for dressing just perfectly for each occasion.
Yes, I mean, and of course, she worked in the fashion industry. She was a model, and she, I think, intuitively understands the power of clothing and how to present yourself in public. It's very, I think it's a very stressful job and role. And when I look at her, sometimes I think of Fawzia and Soraya. I see someone who is not entirely comfortable with the role. And I think that, you know, we've seen examples in public where that has sort of come through. And you have an ability as First Lady to, I think people look at the political power and they say, well, it's all in politics. Actually, with the First Ladies, it's the power is much more interesting because there's an ethical, a moral dimension to it. There's the setting an example, choosing your issues to follow through with in public. So it can take some people, I think, a long time. And so Farah said to me, you know, she first spent her first year, she was so bored, she would get in the car and drive around northern Tehran because she didn't know what she should be doing. There was no handbook for a first lady in Iran. And certainly Soraya and Fawzia had shown very little interest in taking the initiative on their own for issues and causes.
Well, one of the things, of course, that Farah did was her interest in education and actually in translating a book, right?
She did. She told me that was actually a breach of copyright.
I was going to say that, but who cares?
Yeah, she translated, this was to encourage children to read and to publicize her literacy campaign. She not only translated, but she actually drew the illustrations for from a Walt Disney book, a children's book in the early mid-60s. And she's a very good artist. And she told me, that's sort of how hands-on she was. And when she was working with a team of architects to build houses for people who were disabled, not only did she sit in on the meetings with the architects, but she helped design the color schemes. She helped select the furnishings. She said she made sure that if there was a group house, the kitchen would have a big window so that whoever was cooking would be able to look out the window and get fresh air and have a view. You know, so she's very...
And I have to tell people, that's very unusual in Iran, where normally the kitchen is in sort of small and cramped, the cooking utensils were on the floor. So it's
amazing the food that comes out of those small spaces, though.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
We can't even start talking about Iranian food. It is so fantastic. And I hope that right now I wouldn't be traveling to Iran, but in the future hope, and I think anyone who understands the country hopes that things will change, because there is so much potential in Iran. The Iranian people can be so generous and so warm-hearted, and they really want to break out and just to enjoy life again, because there was this period where women were not wearing the chadors. They were working, in banks, and they were working in hotels, and they were working and they were wearing mini skirts. As a matter of fact, most people don't even realize that in Afghanistan, in Kabul, women were wearing mini skirts in those days. The influence of Iran, and that was partly the influence of Iran, that everything was just so different. And then suddenly it was like this dark cloud came over Iran. And this, Khomeini was a dark cloud in many, many ways.
Yes, and the whole region turned. And I think that if it is going to turn back, it's going to come from Iran first. The Iranians are ahead of the curve. They were the first ones to have an Islamic revolution. They were the first ones to go through this, embrace religious fundamentalism. And I think that the young people now are coming out of it. Well, actually, many of them are almost completely out of it. And when they do make the turn in Iran, Iran has the potential to be, I think, a really good friend to the United States. And it may never be as close as it was in the 1960s and 70s under the Shah, because they are a very proud, independent people. But I think that there has to be hope. And that's why I support engagement with the Iranian people, because they really are very sad and desperate, and they deserve so much better than what they've got. And it's a dang tribute to the Iranian American community in this country that Iranian Americans have given so much to the United States since the revolution. They have, we have people at NASA, we have people at MIT, we have people in Hollywood, and those are just the high-profile Iranian Americans. But it's an amazingly cohesive and productive and creative community, and they have just done so much for the United States.
And I feel very hopeful, actually. There's going to be a rough period, but at some point, Iran, as you say, they can be a leader for greatness in the entire region.
Yeah.
It's just a matter now of our people approaching this intelligently. I think all the way back to 63 with the antipathy of Robert Kennedy, and then later Carter, who for some reason did not want to understand the Iranians, because they are a complex people, and you have to look into their hearts and their understand their minds, how they work, because they are not Arabs, this is something important that people have to understand. Sometimes, a lot of the time, trouble that we've had over the years have been because we've thought of them as Arabs, and they're not Arabs. They're Iranians. They're Persians. They're a different type of people.
Very different. And if you want to upset an Iranian, then all you need to say is,
are you Arab?
Are you Arab?
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm running out of time, but I want to thank you again so much for being on Joy on Paper. I just hope people will read this book, get a better understanding of Iran. And the book is called The Fall of Heaven, The Pahlavis, and the Final Days of Imperial Iran by Andrew Scott Cooper. And the paperback came out today, and I hope that you get more publicity for this book and
thank
that
you.
People will actually, they should bring you, I think they should bring you over to New York for a few months, and you should go on the programs and start talking, not just about the book, but to explain Iran so that Americans will understand what's happening there, will understand the importance of Iran, and that we approach the situation. If we approach it in the right way, this can be a peaceful change.
Yes, as you say, if we approach it intelligently, and I just hope and pray that you know, we're going to come through this, and that the Iranians will come through it, and that it won't lead to a war, because that would be just the most disastrous.
Oh, I don't want that. I don't want a war. They had enough with Iraq. They don't need to lose any more people, and I just hope that our people are now having a better understanding, and I think it's wonderful that the Empress is so active and helping to spread the word about what Iran can be and about how important Iranians are to society and to the world.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a very, very very good summation of the situation.
Okay. Well, again, Coop, thank you so much for being on. I hope to talk to you again soon. And when you see the Empress, say that Patsy with a Z said hi, I'm a great admirer of hers. And I want to, again, thank you. Everybody, the book is available wherever books are sold. And get it. It's just a wonderful book, a thriller. not just a nonfiction book. It's a thriller and a wonderful one. Bye-bye now.
Well, thank you so much for your support.
Okay. Bye now. Bye-bye, Coop.
Bye.
Wow. Okay. Wow, that went fast. I didn't do any commercials. I don't care because I just enjoy this book so much. It is a great read. I do hope that you get it because it's an important book. And I love to talk to authors who write important books. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in audible book form. And as a matter of fact, this book is also available in an audible version. Very well done. And it's called The Fall of Heaven. And what else can I say? It's just been such a busy, busy hour. I can't believe that the time just flew by. I just want to say thank you to Big Ed in the control room because we got Andrew Scott Cooper in Belgium. And so we had to get him on Skype. And Ed managed that. And Ed's saluting me and I'm saluting him. And everybody have an absolutely wonderful day. Bye-bye now.